affidavit of Mr. Kekana. And I think you were explaining to the committee his assertion that the report had never been quality assured prior to it being released. Yes?
Yes. Thanks, Chair. Yes, I was explaining that the report was already at the level of the power protector. She had already looked at it. Obviously, she had wanted more time to go through some of the things that she wanted to go through. These include the documents that I had submitted to her, the boxes, two boxes with the evidence. There was never an instruction to me by the power protector that I should refer the report to the quality assurance team. And whatever changes that I've made in the report, those changes were made under the instruction of the power protector. Either when we were working on the draft report that Advocate Madonsela said I had worked on, and at the time when we were finalizing the provisional report that Advocate Kwebana had issued, everything that was done there was done under the instruction of the PP.
And then you see, Mr. Kekana there says he then was of the view that the report that was released, it contained numerous errors and was missing vital information. And he told the PP about this. Do you have anything to say about that, the errors and the vital information missing?
No, I can't comment on that. I think without any specific, you know, indication of the areas that he's talking about, I really have no comment on that.
All right. Go back to his affidavit. Number 49. Yeah, thank you. So you had explained to the committee how SAPS visited your workplace and your home, investigating a leak of the report and so on. Were you requested at any point, because we now know, because we're sitting here, that there was litigation that ensued as a result of the report, the final report in June. Were you requested at any stage to assist in the compilation of the Rule 53 record?
No.
And can you tell the committee of any involvement, if any, you had in the Frede Dairy report?
Okay, the Frede Dairy investigation was being done by the province of Free State. At some point in 2016, the Section 79, if not a provisional report, was then submitted to the think tank that said at that particular time, under Advocate Madonsela at the time. The former PP was not satisfied with the work that was done on that particular investigation. I vividly recall her informing the Free State team that they needed to go back and do some work on that particular investigation. These include interviews, people that were not interviewed, which she felt that they needed to be interviewed. They also include politicians who were not interviewed at that particular time. It also included an issue that she raised about the office conducting what she would term a desktop investigation, in the sense that the investigators had not yet gone to the site where this particular farm or Fred Dairy is. So those were some of the gaps that I still remember that she raised at that think tank. Think tank then took a decision that the report must be referred back to the province, or the Section 79 that had been drafted at that particular time was not ready for release, must be referred back to the province for the province to then finalize that. She was not happy at all, because her view was she had wanted this to be released before she leave the office. It didn't happen, obviously, because of a number of things that were happening at that particular time. With the investigation, some of them obviously do take some longer than others. So that's what transpired, which I can recall in as far as this is concerned.
Just a pause there, Advocate Mayosi. I'm told that live stream is not back after break. Can we check that while leaving people behind? Honorable Hendricks, can you hear us? Honorable Khalif Hendricks, can you hear us? Eid Khafam.
Yes, I can hear you, Honorable Chair, loud and clear.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Honorable Hendricks. Just a pause, want to make sure the live stream is with us. Are we winning IT? Okay, there's an indication that they are back on. Thank you. Apologies, please proceed, Advocate Mayosi.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I do not have further questions for this witness, but I would like to point out, just for hygiene purposes, I guess, that in line with Honorable Heron's suggestion about the parties discussing issues that are not in dispute beforehand and possibly curtailing the time spent on witnesses, the PP's team indicated that in relation to this witness and his affidavit, they are in agreement with paragraphs 1 to 27 of his affidavit, paragraphs 31 to 33, paragraphs 42 to 43, although they may ask questions, they say, they reserve the right to ask whatever clarification questions may arise from his testimony. And then, of course, the rest of the paragraphs they will interact with. I thought I should just point that out. I have no further questions for the witness.
Okay. Thank you, Advocate Mayosi. The time is 11:51. I now recognize Advocate Mpofu.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, can I just also start with a few housekeeping issues before I come to the witness, with your permission?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, the three or four issues which I just want to raise quickly, two of them don't pertain to this witness, the other two pertain to him. So let me start with the broader issues. The first one is, Chair, just for the record and for the attention of the members, to bring it to your attention or to their attention, and also to the attention of the public, because we've been getting inquiries, but we thought before we could respond to those inquiries, out of respect, we should raise this matter here in the formal hearing. And that is the matter, Chair. By now you would have received a letter from us from the 8th, that is the day before the public holiday, pertaining to the request that we're making to you to take the necessary steps to subpoena or summon President Cyril Ramaphosa, given the report that we last gave that he had declined the invitation to appear voluntarily. That letter, I'm sure, has either reached you now, Chair, or it will reach you if it's still in the pipeline. And there have been inquiries about it, but we didn't want to release it to the public domain before we place it on record here. The second issue, Chair, is there's another letter which is coming your way. I'm not sure if it has already been sent. If it's not, it will be with you in the next couple of hours. And that's a separate matter regarding the recall of the witnesses that still had outstanding cross-examination, which we did not finish. And that would be witness Mr. Van Lochrenbeck and Mr. Pillay. That is, as I say, you'll receive it today if you haven't yet received it, if your secretariat has not. Then, Chair, if you can come then to the issues of today. Firstly, yes, to confirm the summary of the areas that we have indicated to the evidence leaders in respect of the suggestion of Honorable Heron, we sought to curtail the time spent on the witness by indicating those areas in respect of which we are in agreement. Obviously, subject to the reservation of our rights, should he say anything in oral argument that we might want to dispute. And there isn't really much. There's one or two issues that we will raise with the witness. Then finally, Chair, it's a request. I don't know how much time we were going to request that we also be given the half an hour that the evidence leaders had to put the matter of CX in perspective. But we can exercise that either by doing it upfront or doing it via the witness. I'm not quite, I don't mind whichever way is preferable, if in principle, if you agree for us to do so. And the reason, Chair, is that we have noticed that the evidence leaders, I mean, they've done this traversal of the cases before Mr. Kekana at the beginning of the matter, I think on the 11th of July, and now again today. And the result of that is that it's almost like legal argument or giving the narrative of the perspective of what the issues are, which is fine, but we should also be able to articulate, so to speak, what the counter narrative is, in this, particularly in respect of section, the judgments. I'm just placing that again on the record, Chair. As I say, I'm neutral as to whether we do it via the witness or we do it up front. So if you want to give us guidance, you may, but it's just a question of
yes.
Principle. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, no, thank you, Advocate Mpofu. The other issues you have raised, especially the first two, I take note of those. We'll Thanks. Wait for both letters, and we'll give you feedback on both those issues. On the last point, because I would have given the evidence leaders between when we started up until lunchtime, and I indicated to them that they don't need to go to lunchtime, so they did not. They've just finished now, and the plan was to have you say from immediately after lunch to 5. So we'll now take you the latest, if you have to, up to 4, kind of. Again, as I said to them, you don't have to go to 4. It's up to you. But on the issue you are raising, it really has to be your comfort. If you think that you want to start with those issues, please do so. If you want to do them as you cross-examine the witness, I think also that should not be a chain smash.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much, Chair. I appreciate that. Then I think what I should do, Chairperson, is I'll do a bit of both. So I'll just outline one or two issues, but some of them I'll lead through the witness, if I may, Chair.
Proceed. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you, Chairperson and honorable members. I just want, firstly, to confirm what Advocate Bauer said, namely that this witness is principally really about the matter of CX. And maybe let me just put, because I think as we go forward, we need to try and focus the inquiry into the issues, because we started, you know, on a wide angle. And I think as we're going along with the particular witnesses, we're now focusing on particular areas. So how we view the landscape is that the motion or the issues that are before you, either from the motion or from the independent panel report, can be condensed into principally four charges, broad charges, as we said on day one, which some of them have sub-charges. But also there are four principal reports or rather judgments which characterize the motion. One of them is CX, which is what we're dealing with now, and I will come back to the specific issues that I want to raise at a broad level around CX. The second one is Frede. And we've touched on Frede both with the witnesses, Samuel and Kekana, to some extent. And then there was a summary of the judgments which was done. So the issues have been outlined there. The third important judgment is the judgment that we call CR17/BUSASA. That is, we have not yet really gone into that particular judgment or that series of judgments. And it also has to do with the subpoena to President Ramaphosa that I mentioned earlier, which I've addressed the committee on previously. So I also don't want to dwell much into that. Simply to flag that we will hopefully deal with the with that stream or that third leg in the same way via witnesses and also summaries of the judgment and so on and so on. Then there's the judgment of the Financial Service Board Conduct Committee, or something like that, which again also has not been dealt with. And then there are other judgments, let's call them that, and that includes the Pillay, Godan, stroke, rogue unit, stream of judgments, which we have dealt with via the witnesses, Van Lochenberg and Pillay so far. Some of those witnesses are going to come back and we will deal with them and finalize that stream. Again, you have been given the judgment summaries and obviously we will call evidence in respect of that. So that's the broad landscape, and the format seems to be that we go through the judgments, analyze them, and then have witnesses on both sides, you know, promoting whatever the narrative and counter narrative, so to speak, or the issues that we want to highlight, that both the evidence leaders and ourselves might want to highlight. Maybe to call it narrative and counter narrative might be to overstate the issue. Right. Now, against that background, that then covers the entire, of course, there's the issue, the so-called HR issues, the alleged harassment, victimization, and intimidation of witnesses, which is a unique type of issue that doesn't really depend on the judgments. So we can flag that as a separate issue. But then that covers the entire motion, so to speak, whether on the wide angle that is preferred by the committee or the narrower angle that is preferred by us, which is based on the independent panel report. Now, coming back then to this leg of the inquiry, which we are busy with now, which is the CX matter. It's important for me just to focus the attention of the committee on what, at least from our point of view, we regard to be the main issues around that report. The first one is the allegation, which is contained and summarized in the report as well. Broadly speaking, that the public protector widened the scope of the investigation. And a whole lot of things fall under that. And I'll deal with them, some of them with this witness now. But I just want to flag it as a heading or a topic here. The second one, which is also isolated properly by the independent panel, is that the remedial action that the public protector issued differs substantially from that which Advocate Matanzela issued. Again, there are many sub-issues that fall under that. The third, which is quite important, is this issue of the judgments. And that's really what I wanted to put in perspective. Because that some of it might come via the witness, some of it not. You will recall, for example, that we conversed some of the issues in the judgments with witness Kekana, and I think to some extent with witness Samuel. And there are two types of issues that we want to flag in respect of the judgments. According to the independent panel, the focus is on the Constitutional Court judgment, and that makes sense because the other judgments were just building up towards that judgment. And that's the one that is allegedly binding and all that. I don't want to enter that debate again for now, for present purposes. But what we want to flag out, and which will also assist in focusing our questioning and hopefully the questioning of the members, is the following. And it's a bit of a concern for us because when these judgments are being summarized, quote unquote, by the evidence leaders, for the second time now, if not the third time, there is a focus only on the majority judgment of the Constitutional Court. And we want to disabuse the process of that notion. Of course, a majority judgment is a majority judgment, and lawyers know what the implications thereof are. But against the background of what this exercise is supposed to be about, this entire inquiry, which is effectively to revisit some of those issues. Otherwise, as we have said many times, there would be no point in having this inquiry. We could simply all just read the judgments and then pass our verdict, so to speak. In our view, the purpose of having this process is exactly to relook into those issues because of the warning that was given by the independent panel report, which is that those judgments would have been given in a different context of review proceedings, as opposed to the current, shall we call it, disciplinary process for misconduct and or incompetence. Now, the importance of the fact that, particularly as far as the CX matter is concerned, there was quite a strong dissenting judgment, which was issued by Judge Justice Mukhweng, CJ, and Justice Goliath. And one might say an equally strong majority judgment issued by Hampempe J and Teron J. And we simply want to, at this early stage, to highlight that at the end, when we are arguing the matter and both in writing and otherwise summarizing, our approach is going to be that the judgment and particular aspects of the judgments of the minority should be preferred for various reasons, which we will converse with the witnesses and also in argument. And again, I don't want to go into the legalities of the issue. Some will say, no, you must ignore the minority judgment. Others might say, as if this was a court, no, it's only the majority judgment that should be looked at. We'll have all those niceties and all those arguments at the right time. We know that the evidence leaders hold the view that the judgments should just be or are binding, quote unquote, whatever that means in the context of an inquiry. And we have expressed our view as to that question, both at the beginning and in the cross-examination of Mr. Pillay, for example. So I'm not entering that terrain. I'm simply highlighting the fact that there are those judgments, and the second judgment in particular, the minority judgment, held quite sharply differing views as in respect of the conclusions that were reached by the majority on the key issues, namely whether there was bad faith, for example, or whether it's important the fact that there was a meeting with the presidency, is it something of significance or not, or of no significance? And Chair, if you allow me, then the last thing I'm going to do, I promise, in respect of that, of putting that perspective, is just to illustrate the point, I will read out some of the passages in the Mogoeng CJ judgment in CX, because that will also feature in my questioning. May I do that, Chair?
Yes, proceed, but you're just going low on your volume.
Let me do the magic trick. How is that now, Chair?
Okay, that's fine. Go ahead.
That better. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Right. Now, the judgments for anyone else who might be listening, the Constitutional Court judgment is reported in as Public Protector versus South African Reserve Bank, 2019, Volume 6, SA 253, the judgment of the Constitutional Court. There are, as I've already mentioned, two separate judgments. The one that I'm going to be dealing with now, well, the evidence leaders have dealt with the majority judgment. And the one that I'm going to talk about is the minority judgment of Mogoeng CJ and Goliath AJ. And I'd like, again, for members of the committee, when they read this, it's not a very long judgment, so I'm sure, that's a relative thing for lawyers and non-lawyers. But the passages that I would recommend for anyone who doesn't want to read the whole thing in respect of the minority judgment would be from roundabout paragraph 56, which deals with gross negligence and bad faith in the context that I've already mentioned. And then from bad faith is paragraph 71 up to 89. So effectively the core of the minority judgment is paragraphs 56 to 89. I won't read all of them, but I'm going to read substantial portions thereof. Right, the background to this is the basis upon which the Constitutional Court would have found that there was bad faith and gross negligence and so on, which then leads to the motion that the public protector must be impeached for those reasons. Right. I'll start at paragraph 57, where the Chief Justice said the following. The Reserve Bank says that it would have explained why the proposed constitutional amendment should not have formed part of the remedial action and why an investigation by the special investigating unit should not be ordered. So the contention is that there was no disclosure of meetings when this was reasonably expected to be done, and there was no further consultation with the banks before the final remedial action was taken. This, the Reserve Bank says, denied it the opportunity to make representations that could possibly have averted a remedial action that could lead to an investigation by the SIU and a constitutional amendment by Parliament. Remember, the then public protector, Ms. Tulisile Madonsela, had already expressed a preference for an investigation in her provisional report, namely a judicial commission of inquiry. And her successor, Ms. Busisiwe Mkhwebane, says that after her meeting with the presidency, incorrectly referred to as having been part of what occurred on 25 April 2017 in her answering affidavit, she realized that the commission route might be problematic since its legality was already a subject of a matter of litigation in relation to another public protector's report, hence her switch to the SIU approach. Just to pause there, the other report referred to, everyone will know, is about the state capture report that the witness mentioned. There was litigation at that stage as to whether it was competent for the public protector to issue remedial action, which calls for a commission of inquiry. So that was the reason why she was exploring the alternatives. Next paragraph, besides something needs to be put into proper perspective here. In her answer of affidavit, the public protector alludes to what is in effect the meeting of 7 June 2017, or both April 2017 and June 2017, as the meeting of 25 April 2017. All things put together, part of what she attributes to the meeting of April actually relates to that of 7 June, as her notes of the latter meeting show. What matters is the content of the discussions and the acknowledgement that the meeting had a role to play in the final determination of the remedial action taken. It cannot therefore be a consequence of a correct and fair assessment of the public protector's version to conclude that she only disclosed the meeting of April 2017, but concealed or was totally secretive about the fact of the one of June 2017 taking place. Doing so could reasonably be misunderstood as being symptomatic of a desperation to find fault. Now, let me pause there again. What the judges were saying is that Advocate Bauer mentioned this so-called secretive meeting this morning when she was summarizing, was that it didn't make sense why it would be of any significance. And it was referred to as a desperation to find fault. Then the next paragraph says, so what was gross about her negligence? Extremely appropriate, clearly or indubitably vexatious or reprehensible by the conduct in relation to A, her interactions with the presidency and the state security agency. Two, her treatment of the transcript of minutes. And three, not affording the banks the opportunity to be heard for the second time after the provisional report was released to interested parties. What harm, actual or potential, was to flow from the public protector's conduct that would explain the, quote, grossness of the negligent conduct? Put differently, whether the reference to the SIU investigation, reprehensible as the public protector's conduct might be or is, what damage did she occasion or could she cause by ordering a different kind of investigation from the one already proposed in the provisional report of Advocate Madonson? That's my addition. Then the learned judge, Chief Justice, then says, if it was in law wrong or negligent of Ms. Mkobana to have changed from an investigation by a judicial commission of inquiry proposed by Ms. Madonsela to an investigation by a specialized prosecution unit, then negligence cannot be gross for that reason alone. For it would be no more than a change of the vehicle for doing that exact same thing based on a wrong understanding of the law. And that extends to her understanding that because the Reserve Bank was not being asked to initiate any process, no remedial action was being taken against it, and it was therefore not necessary for it to be consulted. The reality is that although the Reserve Bank has a material interest in the lifeboat-related process, since its fingerprints are all over it, when it was directed by the public protector to offer its inevitable cooperation in the investigation, it was not required to act unless others, the president and the SIU, did. It ought therefore to be understandable how an error, if it be, could be made by any reasonable person on the basis that since they had been consulted after the provisional report, a second consultation in relation to the same report was not necessary. I'm about to finish this section, Chair. Then it goes on to say, after provisional report was issued and after consulting with the Reserve Bank, the public protector consulted with the presidency at the latter's request. This, the Reserve Bank says, she should not have done since the presidency had nothing to do with her key recommendations or remedial steps, particularly the possible constitutional amendment as it relates to or impacts on economic issues. The Reserve Bank contends that it should have been consulted about economic issues and Parliament consulted about the constitutional amendment instead, but this is an erroneous contention. First, the President of the Republic has a critical role to play in the affairs of this country, including the attainment of safeguarding of good governance or the recreation of corruption-free and truly law-governed environment, especially as regards constitutional institutions. The Reserve Bank must be trusted to, quote, perform its functions independently and without fear, favor, or prejudice. There must therefore be no reason to believe that this constitutionally ordained facilitator of, quote, balanced and sustainable economic growth in the Republic is favorably disposed to some players in the economy in disregard of its mandate or that it could even as much as consider entering into an unlawful contract at a great financial loss to and to the prejudice of the interests of the general public. Allegations of corruption, illegality or impropriety, especially those relating to an amount in excess of 1 billion rand, appear to be sufficiently serious to warrant credible closure via the medium of a thorough investigation, however old the subject matter of investigation might be. And on this, both Ms. Matonsela and Ms. Mkwebane fundamentally agree. I'll jump the next paragraph. The 64, the public protector got the law completely wrong by acting as if it was open to her to direct parliament to amend the constitution and even in a specific way. She, like any other citizen, could of course suggest, but most certainly could not take remedial action to that effect. How then is the gravity of the negligent conduct to be gauged in this connection? Is it with reference to the radical departure from the norm, the failure to appreciate the vital limits of her constitutional powers, or with special regard to the deleterious effect of the proposed amendment? Is the determination of the seriousness of gross nature of negligence relating to the amendment not context specific? Then the Chief Justice goes on to say that it is so context specific. I'll start the next one from the second sentence. Therefore, any endeavor to that end may rightly be criticized and dismissed as bereft of seriousness given the nature of intricacies of lawmaking or constitutional amendment and Parliament's functional independence. The public protector's remedial action was a known or predictable non-starter in legal sectors. The Reserve Bank had access to the best of lawyers who could as urgently as was considered necessary have come there unnecessarily and unreasonably aroused nerves or jitters and those of the markets. That there really was nothing to worry about. Sentiments and sensationalism aside, an objective, reasoned, and calm approach by the public protector, ill-advised or overzealous proposal must inevitably lead to the conclusion that it was inconsequential, never posed any real but only an imaginary threat to the well-being of the Reserve Bank and all other interests, and including reasonably informed economic forces or markets. Remedial action was bound to be set aside with ease. Unsurprisingly, this is important, the public protector did not even oppose its setting aside of that portion. Then there's a discussion on the issue of the vulnerability. As for the meeting, I'm jumping to 67. As for the meeting with the State Security Agency and discussing the Reserve Bank's vulnerability, it must not be forgotten that it was the State Security Agency that virtually initiated the investigation. That's the point I made to Mr. Kekana. To recover whatever the Reserve Bank had given away illegally, that culminated in the CX report. A meeting with them was most appropriate, and we must be loath readily to infer cynicism from that meeting. Once being held, anything including the bank's vulnerability could legitimately be discussed. It is astounding that knowing this, the High Court still went on to conclude that, quote, head discussion pertaining to the Reserve Bank cannot be justified in any manner. It is a factual misdirection. And so is the finding that she was overly secretive about their meeting. How can a secretive person go so far as to waive the classification of the record of her discussion with the same State Security Agency of her own volition? Besides, the discussion of the Reserve Bank's vulnerability is not one of the reasons relied on by the High Court to make the unprecedented order that it made. It thus ill behooves any court to augment the deficient reasoning of the High Court with the vulnerability issue. Then it goes on about the transcript of the minutes, and that's Mr. Kekana's minutes that we've already spoken about. Then the last paragraph 69 says, it bears emphasis that she was under no legal obligation to record and transcribe her meetings with the president, the State Security Agency, or even the banks. And it is inappropriate to use her departure from her own practice and her failure to explain it as one of the grounds for awarding exceptionally high personal costs against her. For it does appear that a lot is being deduced from the record and conduct of the public protector that is not borne out by the facts and the law. But yes, what cannot be denied is that in her somewhat incongruous handling of some of the issues relating to the investigation and reporting, the public protector ultimately disclosed all that is foundational to the possibly alleged grossness of her negligence and her non-disclosure relied on by the Reserve Bank. Apart from the High Court's failure to rely on gross negligence and explain how it was proven, the facts do not bear it out. Then the next section is the one that deals with bad faith, Chair. I'm not going to read it. I'll just pick out one or two issues. Yes, let's start at 72. The correct approach to determining the existence of bad faith is therefore one that recognizes that bad faith exists only when the office bearer acted with specific intent to deceive, harm, or prejudice another person, or by proof of serious or gross recklessness that reveals a breakdown of the orderly exercise of authority so fundamental that absence of good faith can be reasonably inferred from bad faith presumed. This is so because the mischief sought to be rooted out by rendering bad faith so severely punishable, particularly within the public sector space, is to curb abuse of office, which invariably has prejudicial consequences for others. Abuse of office undermines the efficacy of state machinery and denies justice and fairness to all people and instructions. For a person who acts in bad faith is one who hopes to get away with a surreptitious connivance to harm the unsuspecting other. Within the context of this case, the High Court would have had to be satisfied that the public protector has sought to disadvantage the Reserve Bank, acting in cahoots with the presidency or whoever else. Not only would the prejudice have to be explained by the High Court, but the conspiracy or connivance insinuated would have to be classified by the public protector for the devious scheme to succeed. Neither the president nor the state security agencies are competitors with the litigants bank, nor did they initiate the investigation of the public protector that culminated in the final remedial action. It is Mr. Hoffman who did, that's the complainant. The question of favoritism or partiality does not therefore arise. Much more would have had to be said by the High Court in support of the alleged partiality or lack of good faith of the public protector, especially because the prominent role these factors played in awarding the personal and punitive costs. Then I'll jump to 76. Turning to a somewhat different subject, the president would have a role to play in the reopening of the investigation into the lifeboat saga by the SIU. Partiality or bad faith cannot therefore flow or be reasonably inferred from the fact that the president was consulted about this matter. The presidency has a material interest in matters concerning the possible disregard for the law or impropriety of a very important constitutional institution like the Reserve Bank and deserved to be consulted. Nothing sinister or anything that smacks of lack of impartiality or independence ought to flow so effortlessly from the meeting. And the Dr. Tsefo Makoka issue calls for attention as it relates to or seems to undergird the thinly articulated bad faith requirement. Just to save time, Chair, I'll summarize what is stated from paragraph 78 to... ...81. Effectively, what is said there is that the public protector, one of the reasons why she was criticized for having to pay for dishonest debate, faith, and all sorts of things, was because she said she had consulted with economists, with economic experts in plural. Mm-hmm. And it was agreed by everyone that Dr. Goodson, you might remember him being referred to in Mr. Kekana's evidence, was an economist. But it was wrongly assumed, we will show this when we give our evidence, that the reference, the plural reference, was to a Dr. Mukoka, who was, it was common cause, only consulted after the investigation. But the public protector has explained that the other economic expert in that context was the Dr. Moodley, who happened to have worked at the Reserve Bank, but also working state security agents. So that's what's discussed in the paragraphs that I'm jumping. And then I go to paragraph 82, which is what those judges then concluded around that issue. They say, a deceitful or dishonest functionary would not herself have exposed, quote, her lie, or allowed anybody acting on her behalf to do so, especially to those she knew would or clearly determined to use it against her. This explains why the minister did not disclose anything about the work streams. A commonsensical approach to real life issues militates against the adverse inference or conclusion sought to be drawn or reached. This is not a case of being caught or found out. The public protector laid it bare herself. A dishonest conspirator, as the public protector is made out to be, would in all probability have shredded or concealed the documentation. Not even a Rule 53 application has the necessary force to compel a fraudster to discover what she is intent on concealing in order to deceive successfully. Interestingly, for her to know which documents to disclose, logic dictates that she would have had to read her handwritten notes that expose the plot, unquote, or deception by revealing information about the 7th June 27th meeting. The notion that she was being partial or acted in bad faith, and that it is only reasonable inference to be drawn from her failure to disclose this information and not consult with the banks, lacks substance. And it must be emphasized that the conclusion that she was dishonest or deceitful is belied by her declassification of notes of her meeting with the state security agency, her somewhat belated disclosure of all the other information, including the dates of the meetings, her contemporaneous notes of what was discussed, and the effect of the meeting with the presidency on the choice of the vehicle of the investigation. I jump to 86. In sum, the basis for presumably allegedly partial, for the presumably alleged partial or bad faith are just too thin and unexplained. Considerations of justice demand much more to conclude that these have been demonstrated. Besides, there is much to be said for the public protector's contention that just as partiality or apprehension of bias in relation to judicial officers is not highly inferred, so should it be with the public protector. That stems from the presumption of impartiality in their favor, which has more to do with the weight of the constitutional obligation imposed on them to act without fear, favor, or prejudice. The presumption applies subject to appropriate adjustments to the public protector, who is similarly required to act in terms of that constitutional injunction. No wonder even that a high court judge may be appointed to the position of public protector. Yes, I think I'll stop there, Chair, and invite members to read some of those comments for themselves. But that is the perspective that we have been finding to be missing in the multiple summary of the judgments by the evidence leaders. And I'm sure it was not, maybe it was based, honestly based on the notion that the minority judgment does not count, but it does, because the, that's exactly what we're going to be arguing in the end, that the analysis that was the very lucid analysis of the Chief Justice is what should be preferred. We have already demonstrated, for example, on the vulnerability issue that the public protector was being unfairly targeted for something that Mr. Kekana has suggested was his own notes to himself. And we've also demonstrated the issue of the so-called economists. And we will continue doing those. And we intend to do that also via this witness, Chairperson, with your permission. Can I then start with the witness?
Yes, just before you do that, I recognize Advocate Bauer.
Can I just make one correction? I was not dealing with the majority judgment of the Constitutional Court this morning, ignoring the minority. I had said quite clearly I was only dealing with the full bench, and I would come to the Constitutional Court judgments again.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah.
Advocate Mbofu, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chairperson. Well, I just want, just in quick response to that, to say that Advocate Bauer did refer to the judgment, and I think even the issues about the secretive nature and the findings on bad faith and so on, but that's fine. I don't want to quibble about that. She did say that she was going to start with the Murphy judgment and take it right up to the Concord judgment. But in any event, whether she did or not, the independent panel correctly pointed out that the focus should be on the Constitutional Court judgment. Thank you, Chairperson. Good afternoon, Advocate Chiwalule.
Good afternoon, Advocate Mbofu.
How are you this afternoon?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you very much. Yes, you know, as we indicated, there are large sections of your affidavit which we don't take issue with. So the cross-examination is really mainly for clarificatory purpose. It will be relatively painless. And that's because your as we understand it, really your role here is unlike those other witnesses who have an axe to grind or are disgruntled and all that. You are just here to assist the process, correct?
Correct.
Yes. And yours is just to give perspective, and we assume that the evidence leaders wanted for you to give the historical perspective, particularly on the CX matter, correct?
Correct.
Right. And I just want to confirm that, just for perspective and context, I mean, you are an advocate, you know the importance of context, correct?
Correct.
Right. And here, first of all, we're dealing with a report for events, or rather the investigation started around about 2011, to your knowledge. You may not have been involved with it, but about 2011, correct?
Correct.
Right. And I'm sure you would agree that it took much longer than it should have, this investigation, correct? Sorry, Mr. Chalula?
He said correct. Maybe yeah, you missed
oh,
that.
Oh, sorry. I missed that. There's something that means there was something wrong on our side. Thank you very much. Thank you for that. In that, surely an investigation should not take almost the full term of a public protector from 2011 up to 2016 would be about 6 years, correct?
Right.
Yeah. And be that as it may, it is also so that the, I'm just jumping towards the other extreme now, towards the end. You have correctly pointed out that Advocate Matonsela was quite determined. It was one of the reports that she would have wished to issue before her term expired, correct?
Correct.
But as these things happen, that last rush that you and her participated in did not result in the issuance, in the finalization of the report, correct?
Correct.
And that, just to digress a little bit, there were, let's say, three, at least to my knowledge, and you might correct me if I'm wrong, three big investigations which she had hoped to finalize before she leaves, but somehow failed to do so. One of them was the CX report, as we have just confirmed. The other one was the Frieda report, and then of course the well-known state capture report, correct?
Correct. There were also others. I think just to add on that, there were a number of them. I think there were more than 10 reports that she had wanted to release. I do recall the investigation regarding, I think, the Free State website. There was also an investigation about Mandela funeral. She wanted that finalized as well. There was also an investigation regarding the funds that were that disappeared in the, I think, Baboba Mohale, in Northwest.
So Northwest,
yes. Yeah, so a lot of work had been done on that, but obviously there were things that she felt that they still needed to be closed off or finalized before those reports could go out, or their the Section 79 notices could go out.
Yes, fair enough. So the what I call these three big reports were, you are simply saying that they were part of a bigger pool of reports that she would have, all things being equal, she would have wanted to finalize before her departure, correct?
Correct.
Right. Now, one of the disturbing features about coming back now to the CX report is the fact that you remember there's one of the things that Advocate Mkhwebane is criticized for is her alleged failure to adhere to the 5-day promise which was made to the Reserve Bank that they would be given prior notice of the final report, something like that. You remember that?
You're referring to the 10 days, I think it's 10 days, in a meeting that I was not part of. I do recall that advocate, a counsel for, I think, Reserve Bank wrote to the PP inquiring about that, there was a promise that they would be given a report and they'll be given 10 days within which they will then comment on the provisional report before it was released. That's all I can remember in as far as that is concerned.
Yes, actually, it was both a 10-day and a 5-day promise alleged. 10 days, I think you're right, before it would be... all right, I'll find it now, but... Okay, putting aside the number of days, the point that I was really driving to is on their version, that promise had been made in 2013, correct?
Correct.
September 2013, to be exact, yeah.
Correct.
Yes. And there was even a letter which they say they wrote, I think in September 2013, which had not been answered by 2016.
Yes. Maybe to provide context to that, Advocate Mpofu, through you, Chair, yes. That letter relate, if I my memory serves me well. It related to an argument that was being raised by Reserve Bank and I think the Minister of Finance, if I'm not mistaken, or APSA, where their argument was that this investigation related to issues that predate the establishment of the Office of the Power Protector, and that we should actually not touch it. When I joined the investigation, these issues were brought to my attention as well, that the reason the investigation has stalled so much was because there was this to and fro and arguments that have been raised by the parties involved that, well, why are you investigating this issue? It's a deadwood. It's an issue that happened even before your office was established. But I remember advancing an argument that says the issue here is not about the things that happened prior to the establishment of the Office of the Power Protector, but rather the issues are about what the government did when the government entered into the agreement with CX. That was done after the establishment of the Office of Power Protector. So we are only mainly focusing on that, and we are not focusing on what transpired between 85 and 1992, to be precise.
Yes. No, fair enough. Yes. But nevertheless, I thank you for that background. If you go to page 3291, that is a letter from the Reserve Bank to the Public Protector, quite a long letter. You remember that letter?
You said 3291.
Yes, Chairperson.
Okay, thank you. We'll flight it if you don't have it there.
Yeah. No problem. The letter actually starts at 3285. Maybe we should just run it from there. Just, it's quite a comprehensive letter, just to show that it's... Yes, okay. It's a letter from the Reserve Bank to Advocate Mkwebane. Can you just run it? Just run it until you get to 3291. I just want to demonstrate that it's quite a longish letter and detailed. you remember this letter, Advocate?
Yes, I do.
Yes. In your statement, it is, I think it's just a mistake. You refer to that letter as coming from Mr. Chris van der Walt. But in fact, it came from Advocate De Jager, correct? Or a Dr. De Jager.
Can you please go down to the last page so that at least I can confirm that?
Yes, that will be a 3294, yes.
Yes, yes, you're quite correct.
Yes, and if you go to 3145, which is your statement, Yes, you'll see that you say on 25 November 2016, we received correspondence from Mr. Chris van der Walt of the SARB. I'm just saying that unless if I'm missing something, from my recollection, this letter was 25 October 2016. And also it came from Dr. De Jager, not Mr. van der Walt. That's not important. I'm just simply saying, just making sure that we're dealing with the same letter. Am I right?
Correct.
Thank you. Okay. All right. So subject to those minor corrections, for the record, Chair, the letter therefore was actually 25 October 2016 and came from Mr. De Jager. So the necessary changes would have to be made to paragraph 22 of the witness statement. But as I say, nothing much turns onto that. All right. Now we can then go to paragraph 3291, which is where I was leading to. Right. Just to confirm that around there where they talk about Ms. Ms. Marcus and Mr. Mboweni, just keep rolling a little bit. Yeah, it's to confirm what you were saying, Advocate, that this there was this discussion about prescription, rather jurisdiction, I think is a better word. Namely, yes. whether the, in terms of Section 6(9) of the Public Protector Act, whether the public protector would have been entitled to investigate something that was older than 2 years in terms of its occurrence. That's what you are referring right. to. Yes.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah, okay, we'll come back to that. What I want to discuss for now is, if you go to 3.12, yes, that this is the complaint that the public, rather the Reserve Bank was raising in the letter, that they had written this letter in 2013, and they say there was no response to this letter from the public protector for about 3 years. You remember that?
Yes, I do.
Yes, and it is in that context where I was saying that this particular report really should have been finalized earlier, and I think you have agreed with me on that, correct?
Yes, I do agree with you, and for the reasons that I've provided, which I was told why there was that delay. I want to make sure that I stress those, yeah.
Yes, and it was before your time anyway.
Yes, it was before my time anyway, but I had to inquire why this had taken so long, obviously. As you have indicated, it was unusual for an investigation to take this long, and I've highlighted why it did as the reasons were provided to me.
Yes, right. Okay, right now, this public protector advocate Mkwebane, and I'm just trying to find if your comment would be, or rather whether you would agree with me, once again, dealt with this matter as a matter of priority, correct?
Yes.
Yes. And she dealt with it with the due efficiency that it required, in that, for example, according to your testimony, within a matter of weeks of her taking office, she was already asking you, and you were giving her the boxes and all that, the evidence that you've already given, correct?
Correct.
Yes. And the result of all that was that, in fact, I thought you were being slightly unfair on Advocate Mkwebane, and I don't think you intended to, when you said in November she had not yet read the boxes. This would have been understandable because she had just taken office. It was hardly a month after taking office, correct?
Are you referring to the paragraph of my affidavit where I mentioned the issue of me asking her whether she had already gone through the evidence yes. I had submitted?
I'm referring to that. Yes, I'm referring to that, and I think you also commented on it this morning. I'm simply saying that if you look at it in perspective, she acted with due efficiency, given the fact that this investigation was already 6 years old, that within 2 or 3 weeks, there had already been an exchange of the boxes between you and her, and the downloading of the information.
Yeah.
And given the fact that it was not the only report that is outstanding, I'm not making a big thing out of it. I'm simply saying that she had acted with deliberate speed.
Yes, I would say so.
Thank you.
I agree with you.
Thank you very much. Now, the other issue is that you had again correctly pointed out that in your estimation, one of the reasons why you had been retained in the private office was for the sake of, shall we call it, continuity and institutional memory, correct?
Yes, correct. And I think I must qualify that, Advocate Mpofu. I didn't, obviously, in the beginning, because I saw things that were happening in the private office where other people, for example, chief of staff and other officials who were there working with Advocate Madonsela, including two of our PAs and also the secretary, when they were all told that they should now go and report elsewhere in the different units. When I was retained, I had a discussion with my colleagues, why am I still there? Why? Because I thought I was going to be taken out of that particular space by virtue of probably working with the previous PP. But obviously, I had an understanding that I was a professional. I didn't had any allegiance to Advocate Madonsela. You know, she didn't even know me when I was appointed there. So similarly, I would continue to work with the new PP. I had no issues even when I was there. So that was the issue. So, but obviously I was concerned that not only are officials who were working with me, all of them out of that space, and there are new people that I now have to work with. So that was just an issue that I noted as well.
Yes, no, fine. I don't think there's much to be said about that. Have you worked in government before?
Yes, I have.
Yes, so you, which department?
I worked at IDT, Independent Development Trust.
Oh, okay, not in an actual department, in an agent. No, I was going to, but just knowing, working in that space, you would know that, for example, this is for what is known as the private office of a minister. Normally, when there's a change of minister, those people either go with that minister or the new minister brings their own private staff. But in the DG's office, for example, there'd be permanent continuity. You are familiar with that?
Yes, I am.
Yes, thank you. All right. Now, given you found alternative employment of your own volition, correct?
Correct.
You were not purged or anything like that. You just found another job.
Yeah, no, I was not purged. I found another job and I felt that I had already done my part. There were several engagements I had with Advocate Mukwevana because I sent her my letter of appointment and she congratulated me for that. And obviously she was concerned that I'll be leaving some way that I had not yet finalized. And following that, there were just engagements that are normal where people say we could try and counter your offer or whatever, but didn't get to anything that I can obviously say.
Okay. No, thank you very much. No, in fact, that is the evidence that African Kobano was going to give that, but thanks for confirming that far from paging you, she was actually trying to retain you if she could, but obviously your other offer, we won't ask you how good that other offer was, but it was...
They couldn't afford me. Let's put it that way, they couldn't afford me, so that's why I'm
okay. Yes, yeah. No, that's fine, yeah. Thank you. But of course, there was that qualified, although she congratulated you, she did point out, because obviously she was apprehensive about if you were just going to say, I'm leaving tomorrow. I'm not saying that's what you intended to do, but it was important for there to be that 30-day period so that you could then do a proper handover of the, particularly of the handover files, the files that were straddling between Advocate Madonsela's era and the new era, correct?
Correct.
Right. Okay, now, then comes this issue.
Maybe Advocate Mpofu, on that point, if we can ask you to pause.
Yes, sir.
We'll take a lunch break and be back at 2.
No, thank you, sir. That's convenient. I was going to start a new topic.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We pause, break for
recording
lunch, back
stopped.
At 2.